Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're getting into something pretty complex, a field with a whole bunch of different names around the world, but it's all aimed at treating pain without surgery, using hands-on methods. We're talking about manual and musculoskeletal medicine. Let's call it M-medicine. So our mission today is, well, it's crucial. This is a global field, it's regulated, but the training, the titles, they're all over the place. We want to really nail down the definitions, look at the huge global health problem it tackles, and figure out why these international guidelines are trying to bring some harmony to it all.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how something so fundamental dealing with movement and pain can look so different depending on where you are. Basically, MM medicine is about managing issues with the neuromusculoskeletal system.
Okay, so nerves, muscles, bones, how they all work together.
Exactly. And yes, officially regulated in about 40 countries, but how? That varies massively. Sometimes it's a full medical specialty. Other times, maybe it's just, you know, a part of training in neurology or orthopedics or even family medicine.
That variation. Yeah, that's definitely something we need to unpack. Okay, let's start right there with the names. When we say MM medicine, what are the core bits? First up, you've got manual medicine. That sounds like the hands-on part.
Pretty much. It focuses on using hands for diagnosis and treatment, specifically for that neuromusculoskeletal system.
Right. And then there's musculoskeletal medicine. Yeah. How's that different?
It's a bit broader. It covers the medical diagnosis and therapy for, well, all functional problems and structural issues of the whole locomotor system, how you move. You often see it formally established where there isn't already a strong non-surgical pathway for these kinds of joint and muscle problems.
Okay. And the U.S. has its own specific flavor of this, right?
It does. A really interesting example, actually. They have osteopathic manipulative medicine, or OMM. It's this whole approach combining an osteopathic philosophy, structural diagnosis, and the hands-on part, which they call osteopathic manipulative treatment, or OMT.
OMT. Got it.
And what's really unique in the U.S. is a Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree, the DO. Their training integrates manual medicine right from the start, all through the 4 years before they graduate.
Wow, so all DOs graduate with some level of hands-on treatment skills.
That's the idea. It gives them a foundational capacity. It's not just an add-on later. It's built in.
Okay, so that's the baseline for DOs. But can you specialize further in the U.S.?
Absolutely. There's a nationally recognized physician-only specialty called Osteopathic Neuromusculoskeletal Medicine.
O-M?
O-N-M.
M-M.
Yep. And that's a serious commitment. It's a full-time, 36-month, supervised residency program.
3 years.
3 years. And it's open to both MD and DO graduates who really want to become experts, the researchers, the educators in this specific area.
Interesting. So how does that compare globally? Are there similar specialist paths elsewhere?
There are, but the structure often differs. Take Russia, for example. They have manual therapy as a medical specialty. But to even start that training, you first have to fully qualify as a neurologist or an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh, wow. So it's an additional specialization on top of another major one.
Exactly. It's a capacity added later, unlike the integrated USDO model we just talked about.
What about other places, like Asia?
Different again.
Yeah.
In Japan, you hear about arthrokinematics. It's more an approach to teaching techniques, focusing very specifically on how joint surfaces interact.
Arthrokinematics. Joint surfaces. Okay.
And in the Republic of Korea, there's Chuna Manual Medicine. That's a therapy focused on biomechanics, trying to create balance in the body's structure and function.
So different names, different training routes.
But the common thread is physicians using hands-on, non-surgical methods to treat pain and dysfunction.
Okay, that clarifies the what. Now let's talk about the why, the scale of the problem this field addresses. You said it was staggering.
It really is. The global burden from musculoskeletal or MSK disorders is just enormous.
Yeah, that's some numbers.
Okay, try this. In 2021, the estimated global economic hit was over $2 trillion.
$2 trillion.
Yep. That's about 1.4% of the entire global GDP, just on muscle, bone, and joint problems.
That's unbelievable. Is it getting worse?
The projections aren't great. We were at about 1.7 billion cases worldwide in 2021. That's expected to jump past 2.16 billion by 2035.
Wow.
And the biggest single cause of disability worldwide, measured in years, lived with disability, still low back pain.
Low back pain. Yeah, you hear that all the time. So the need is massive. How does medical training stack up against that need?
Terribly. That's the shocking part. Depending on the country, somewhere between, say, 14% and almost 28% of all visits to primary care doctors are for MSK issues.
Okay, so maybe 1 in 4 visits.
Right. But guess how much time medical schools, on average, spend teaching MSK topics in the entire curriculum?
Uh-oh. I'm guessing it's low.
It's 2.3%.
2.3% for something causing maybe 25% of doctor visits.
Exactly. See the mismatch. Less than 3% of training time for potentially a quarter of their future work.
That seems fundamentally flawed. Does that gap show up in practice?
Oh, absolutely. There are U.S. studies showing more than half of family physicians feel they didn't get enough training in orthopedics or manual assessment skills back in medical school. They're relying on that tiny slice of education.
And I bet that has cost implications.
Huge ones. Think about it. If primary care isn't fully equipped, what happens?
More referrals.
Yeah.
More tests. Delay in getting the right treatment.
Precisely. And the data backs it up. The most complex 5% of MSK patients end up accounting for something like 61% of the total costs.
61%. Why so high?
Often because they miss out on timely, effective conservative care early on. Things escalate. More imaging, specialist visits, maybe unnecessary procedures, chronic pain sets in. It's a vicious cycle.
Okay, so this is where MM medicine physicians could step in.
This is exactly their sweet spot. They have that dual skill set, advanced diagnosis, and the manual treatment tools. They're perfectly positioned to break that cycle early.
Right. So if the current approach is costing trillions, partly due to delays and inadequacy, what's the value proposition of MM medicine? How does it save money or improve care? It boils down to efficiency and effectiveness, really. It's conservative care, non-invasive, generally lower risk than surgery or long-term meds, and it's often very cost-effective. There was a trial in Sweden, for instance.
Yeah, what did it find?
It showed that manual therapy, up to 6 sessions, was actually cost-effective compared to just giving advice, which is basically the cheapest possible intervention.
More effective than just advice and worth the cost.
From a societal perspective, yes. And that cost-effectiveness isn't just luck. These practices usually have lower overhead. They often combine the diagnosis and the treatment in the same visit, which saves time and money. And the big one, early intervention to stop acute pain becoming chronic pain.
Okay, that makes sense. But if it's so good, why all the effort to standardize it? You mentioned FEM, the International Federation for Manual Medicine. If the approaches are so varied globally, what's the point of trying to make them uniform?
But that variation is precisely why FEM's work is so important. They aren't necessarily trying to make everyone identical, but to ensure a baseline standard of quality and safety, no matter the local name or regulatory status.
So job one is patient safety.
Absolutely. Patient protection is paramount. Setting high qualification standards minimizes risks, especially with hands-on treatments.
Okay. What else?
Second is standardizing the training itself. Defining clear competency levels, what needs to be in the curriculum for certification or licensing, makes everything more transparent.
And third?
International harmonization. Getting everyone aligned with recognized standards makes it easier for qualifications to be accepted across borders. You know, a well-trained doc in Germany could potentially have their skills recognized more easily in Australia, for example.
Mobility and recognition, that's key. And thinking ahead, standardization must be important for new technologies too, like digital health.
Definitely. We're seeing huge potential for tele-MM. Think remote triage, guiding patients through exercises via video, maybe even using AI tools to analyze movement patterns from videos.
Tele-MM, interesting. So parts of the assessment and guidance could be done remotely.
Exactly. Especially the history taking, visual assessment, patient education pieces. It could really boost access, especially in rural areas, and further improve that cost effectiveness we talked about.
Okay, let's circle back to the training itself. You mentioned different models globally. Can you break those down a bit more?
Sure. Broadly speaking, you see two main structures for how physicians get trained in MM medicine around the world. First, there's what FEM calls the capacity model. This is usually like a subspecialty, often a diploma you get after your main medical specialty.
Like the Russian example, neurologist first, then manual therapy.
Exactly like that. Mm-hmm. It requires a minimum number of hours, typically around 300, of postgraduate modular training. You see this a lot in Europe and Australasia. It adds the capacity onto an existing specialist.
Okay, 300 hours postgrad. What's the other model?
The component model. Here, the MM medicine training is woven into the fabric of a primary medical specialty curriculum itself.
So it's not an add-on, it's part of the main training package, like musculoskeletal medicine specialists.
Right. Competence in manual medicine is a required component of becoming that type of specialist from the get-go.
And the U.S. system for DOs, where does that fit? It sounded like a bit of both.
It kind of spans the models. That baseline training all DOs get, the minimum 300 predoctoral hours. You can see that as a kind of integrated component model establishing foundational skills.
Okay.
But then that intensive ONMM residency we mentioned, the 36-month one, that's way beyond the basic capacity model's 300 hours. FAYM would classify that as the highest level, a master or doctoral level specialty. We're talking over 1,200 hours of integrated specialized training. These are often the people teaching and researching MM medicine in the U.S.
I see. So multiple levels of potential training, even within one country. And MDs in the U.S. can access this too.
Yes. MDs can also train in MM medicine, either through specific residency programs that have what's called osteopathic recognition, reaching that component, or even the master doctorate specialty level.
It's complex, but the pathways are becoming clearer. Now, this all sounds quite modern with residencies and federations, but the idea of hands-on treatment is ancient, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly ancient. We're talking techniques described in the Edwin Smith Papyrus from Egypt, maybe 4,500 years ago.
Wow.
Hippocrates in ancient Greece wrote about manipulation. Avicenna and the medieval Islamic world, too. The core idea isn't new at all.
So when did the modern structures like osteopathy and chiropractic emerge?
That was much more recent, mid to late 19th century, primarily in the U.S. Andrew Taylor still developed osteopathy around the 1870s. Daniel David Palmer founded chiropractic a couple of decades later.
So these formalized schools grew out of those much older traditions.
Exactly. And the fact that we're now talking about global standards and FEM guidelines shows how the field has matured and is working to, you know, build on those historical roots with modern evidence and safety standards.
Before we wrap up, let's touch on the philosophy again. You mentioned a holistic view, the body self-regulating. What does that practically mean for a patient with, say, chronic neck pain?
Okay, good question. Self-regulating means the body is always trying to find balance to heal itself. When an MM physician treats that neck pain, they're looking for what's called segmental dysfunction.
Segmental dysfunction, like a specific spot that's stuck or not moving right?
Kinda, yeah. Think of it as a localized glitch in a joint or spinal segment that's messing up nerve signals and muscle function nearby.
Yeah.
It's causing pain or restricting movement.
And the holistic part?
The holistic part means the physician doesn't just focus on nudging that stuck segment back into place. They look bigger picture. What else is going on? Is there poor posture contributing? Limited mobility elsewhere forcing the neck to compensate? Even chronic stress impacting muscle tension? They look for the underlying reasons why the body lost its ability to fix that glitch itself.
So the treatment isn't just the manipulation.
The manipulation, the hands-on work, is often key to removing the immediate mechanical barrier. But the goal is bigger. Help the body restore its own natural healing and self-regulating processes. The physician is more like a facilitator for the body's own recovery.
That focus on structure, function, and the body's own systems, that feels like the core difference. Okay, stepping back then, the big picture for you, our listener, is this. MM medicine is this evolving global specialty. It's grounded in evidence, and it's focused on conservative, hands-on care for this absolutely massive burden of musculoskeletal problems. The names and training paths vary a lot, but there's this growing push for standardized, high-quality physician training, whether it's 300 hours added on or a full multi-year residency, all aimed at protecting patients.
And we've seen that the current way we train doctors just isn't enough to handle the scale of MSK issues, leading to huge costs and disability. These standardization efforts, through groups like FEM, are vital for preparing qualified physicians to fill that critical gap in diagnosis and effective treatment.
So, considering everything we've discussed, the evidence showing MM medicine can be cost-effective, especially with early access, and the potential to scale it up using digital tools like TeleMM. Here's a final thought for you to chew on. How could public health policy better weave these specialized MM physicians into primary care, into preventative health strategies? Could integrating them more effectively be the key to finally making a dent in the world's single biggest cause of disability, shifting MSK care away from just managing chronic pain towards preventing it in the first place?